In 1990, a 19-year-old soldier went on an inexplicable killing spree. In one night, three victims lost their lives. When the offender stood before a judge, the question was not whether or not he did it, but rather whether a personality disorder, one psychiatrist likened to a disability, had played such a major role in his crime that he should not pay the ultimate price for his crimes. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 209, The Crime Spree of Pieter van der Merwe. True Crime South Africa is an independent podcast and relies on listener support to keep going. There are many ways you can support the podcast. You can check out all of them at truecrimesouthafrica.com. The most impactful way is by joining True Crime South Africa exclusives on Patreon or Paybrew or Apple subscriptions or YouTube memberships. Among other benefits, you'll get free access to online TCSA events, exclusive episodes, discounts on my audiobooks, and ad-free episodes. So you don't have to listen to me say this every week. Listen through to the end of the episode where I discuss more ways you can help support the podcast. Today's case takes us back to a period in South Africa where our political and social landscape was changing faster than at any other time during our history over a relatively short period. And that change impacted our legal system equally significantly. There's such a distinct difference when I look back at older cases on this podcast in how courts viewed the criminal mind and the kinds of sentences they imposed. We certainly have a much better understanding today of the psychology behind crime, and that is evidence in judgments and sentencing documents I read. From a sentence perspective, when I look back at cases during the period in which the death penalty was available, I've said before how I feel like there is this huge gaping hole between sentence severities. For serious violent crimes, the death penalty was on the table. But then you'd also see 20-year determinate sentences for domestic violence murders, where the perpetrator would be up for parole in 10 years. Just a vast difference, and very little consistency, from what I've seen at least. In today's case, you'll be hearing about a court's deliberation around something that today is pretty well established in law. But I think it's also really interesting to see how they looked at the issue of elements of personality disorders in offenders in the early 1990s. Another aspect of this case that we don't get to see a lot is that this is a true spree crime, which fits the acknowledged definition. In researching this case, I primarily used the court documents, as well as a few media articles I managed to find which had been scanned into and uploaded to the Sabinet directory. So, let's get into episode 209, The Crime Spree of Pieter van der Merwe.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
Pieter John van der Merwe was born in 1971. His childhood was described as unhappy, but the details of that never rose to the level of mitigation in court, so little detail was provided. That, of course, does not mean that an individual's experience of their own childhood was not impactful on them in some way. We all view our own experiences through the lenses built by our nature and the nurturing we've been given. What we do know is that by the time Pieter was 18, he already had a significant criminal history. He'd been convicted for 5 different offences, 2 which involved dishonesty or fraud, 1 for reckless driving, another for illegal possession of a firearm. The 5th and most concerning was a culpable homicide conviction when he was a minor for having caused the death of someone in a car accident. There's no mention of what sort of sentences he was given for these convictions, but in the 1980s, corporal punishment was common for minor offenders, although one would think that by offence number 5, during his teens, someone would have figured out that that was not working. There were also facilities where minor offenders could serve out incarceration sentences during that time. But even there, there was little focus on rehabilitation, and more focus on physical punishment. The idea was that criminal behaviour could be disciplined out of individuals, especially minors, and they could be set on the right path simply by forcing them to comply through fear, violence, and physical discipline. And while I was shocked at where life took Peter next, considering his history, perhaps it sort of fits with this idea that harsh discipline will fix everything. Because by the time Peter van der Merwe was 19 years old, he was in the army. Despite having 5 criminal convictions, and especially one where he'd illegally possessed a firearm, he was accepted into the South African Defence Force and given access to a gun. Of course, at this time, there was compulsory military conscription for all white males in South Africa from the age of 18, sometimes even 16, depending on whether they were still in school or not. Because the apartheid government was involved in the border war and simultaneously using the army to control black communities who were protesting their human rights being impeded upon, the SADF's requirement for numbers took precedence over almost everything. And it's well documented that a criminal history did not deter them from conscripting a young man. Essentially, they needed a body to hold a gun and be ready to fire it. If the mind controlling that body had a few glitches along the way, they were willing to deal with that. And at least in this case, and I have no doubt in many others, giving an already prolific teenage offender a deadly weapon and literal training on how to kill would have deadly consequences for at least 3 innocent people. Thankfully today, at least according to their publicly available recruitment policies, the now SANDF does not recruit individuals who have a criminal record. But that doesn't mean that the type of person Peter van der Merwe was at his core is not still finding its way into the armed forces. In fact, the type of person he was might just be their ideal candidate in many ways, but we'll chat more about that later. Peter's behavioural problems, not surprisingly, did not go away when he entered the army. He was stationed at a base in Potchefstroom and quickly built up a significant history of being absent without leave, or AWOL. He was caught out on 6 occasions. One occasion involved more than 2 months straight of being absent from base before he returned like nothing had happened. He was disciplined for these infractions through the army's procedures, but it would later emerge that this did nothing to stop his behaviour. Funny that. As for the last 2 months before he would commit the crimes that would get him arrested, he was actually AWOL from the base every single night of those 2 months. Peter was just more careful about not getting caught. Whenever a convicted killer makes claims about having some illustrious military career where they were part of secret operations or something similar, I am immediately suspicious. And Peter would prove that suspicion warranted. He told many people, including a social worker who would eventually work on his case, that he had already built up quite a track record in the army. He said he'd served time at the border, and he had, quote, had contact with the enemy, end quote. And he also claimed that he'd worked as a sharpshooter, eliminating targets from a moving helicopter. None of that was true. Peter van der Merwe had never left the base in Potchefstroom on an official mission. The only time he'd left base was when he was absent without leave. On the evening of the 30th of January 1990, Peter van der Merwe was not on duty, but he was still not allowed to leave the base without permission. That had never mattered to Peter, though. But on that night, he seemed to have a different plan than his usual excursions to local bars and shebeens. He approached a fellow soldier and asked him if he could use his R4 rifle for the night. He told the soldier that he was being sent on a mission to escort a vehicle to Pretoria, but his own rifle was locked in the armory and he couldn't get it out. Apparently not questioning why their superiors would send a soldier on a mission and not release his firearm on request, the young man had agreed and handed over his R4. The truth, of course, was that there was no mission, and Peter couldn't ask for his own firearm to be released because he was not on duty, and his senior officers would never have allowed it. Once he'd secured the firearm, he found the keys to one of the Defence Force Land Rovers, which were not supposed to leave the base without permission from the superior in charge. He got in, and he drove out of the base around 7 p.m. Peter's first stop that night was at a friend he called Bezadenhout. The man lived in Klerksdorp, and when Peter arrived there, he told his friend that he was on a scheduled break from a mission he was conducting, which involved a security convoy between the Northern Cape and Potchefstroom. No such mission existed, of course, but Peter was certainly good at spinning a yarn at the drop of a hat. Bezadenhout would later testify in court that Peter had behaved completely normally that night. They'd shared two or three beers, and then Peter said he had to set off again. And he did, although he had no intention of going back to base. Instead, he drove toward Ventersdorp and away from the base. Jacob Morake had the distinct misfortune of being on the same road at the same time as Peter that night. He was attempting to hitchhike, so when the army Land Rover pulled over and a soldier offered him a lift, it's likely Jacob thought that this was a pretty good option to get where he was going. Of course, the other side of this is that, like the police at the time, the army were a force used against the majority of people in South Africa. So even if Jacob had concerns about getting into the vehicle, he probably would have felt pressured to agree. Jacob got into the Land Rover, and Peter drove for a few kilometres toward Ventersdorp. Just before entering the town, though, Peter pulled over on the side of the road and told Jacob to get out. The man complied, thinking that this was the end of his lift, and started to walk away. But Peter didn't drive off. Instead, he got out of the Land Rover too with his R4. Jacob, walking and facing away from Peter, probably didn't even know what happened when van der Merwe struck him in the back of his head with the butt of his rifle. As Jacob crumpled to the tar, Peter aimed the firearm at him and fired a single shot into his head. He died instantly. Leaving Jacob Morake's body at the side of the road, Peter turned the Land Rover around and started to drive back to Klerksdorp. Along the way, he saw a minibus taxi pulled over on the side of the road. Inside were taxi driver Pietrus Sienko and his girlfriend, Paulina Sekala. The pair had been sitting, chatting and smoking cigarettes before Pietrus took Paulina home, when they saw the Land Rover pull up behind them and a soldier got out. Peter knocked on Pietrus's window, and when he rolled it down, he asked to see Pietrus's license. Now, To be fair, there is absolutely no reason for a Defence Force member to be demanding to see anyone's license, but this was apartheid South Africa. And a black man being faced with a white man in uniform with a very large gun. Of course, he was going to comply. Peter looked at the license and then handed it back to Pietras. He glanced over at Paulina and told Pietras to get out of the taxi and come with him. Having no idea why he was seemingly being taken into custody, Pietras complied and got into the Land Rover. Peter pulled the taxi's keys out of the ignition and dropped them into his pocket. He told Paulina to stay there, and they'd be back soon. Back in the Land Rover, Peter drove back the way he'd gone with Jacob. Pietras occasionally asked where they were going, but Peter didn't answer. Then, about 10 minutes into the drive, he pulled over and told Pietras to get out. The man did as he was told, and within seconds he felt the cold metal of the rifle pushed up against his head. Peter fired a single shot, killing Pietras instantly. He then got back into the Land Rover and drove back to where Paulina was still sitting inside the taxi. Peter van der Merwe raped Paulina Sekala before shooting her in the head. He stole all of her jewellery from her dead body before leaving her on the side of the road beside the taxi. With 3 murders and 1 rape committed in the space of just hours, Peter calmly drove back toward Klerksdorp. But he wasn't quite finished with his spree for the night yet. As he drove through the town, he noticed a deep-sea fishing boat hitched to a trailer parked in the lot of a used car dealer in the main street. Peter pulled over, manoeuvred the Land Rover into position, and hitched the boat onto the back of the Land Rover, before driving away with it. He then drove to the residence of a fellow soldier, who lived in the army flats, but not on the base. The man was working a night shift, so he was not home. Peter unhitched the boat and pushed it around the corner into a parking lot. Then he parked the Land Rover separately from it and made his way into his friend's flat. Other residents of the flat, who'd heard the noise he'd made while moving the boat, put his arrival at around 2 a.m. Peter then quickly fell asleep. As dawn began to break, the bodies of Jacob Morake, Pietras, Senjo and Paulina Sekala were discovered. The significant gunshot wounds the victims had sustained immediately had police believing they were looking for an offender with a large caliber rifle. But it would be the stolen boat that solved their murders. When the car sales lot had opened that morning and staff had noticed that the boat had been stolen, they'd immediately alerted police. A Be On The Lookout was sent out to police officers in the area, and a patrolling officer spotted the boat parked near the army flats. A resident had indicated that they'd seen the boat coming in the early hours of the morning, and it had been attached to the Defence Force Land Rover that was still parked in the parking lot. After knocking on a few doors, they located the man who had driven it there the night before. Peter van der Merwe had still been fast asleep when the knock came on the door of his friend's flat, seemingly completely unbothered by what he'd done the night before. He'd been arrested for the theft of the boat, and the R4 in his possession, as well as his uniform he was wearing, had been taken by police. It wouldn't take long for officers investigating the 3 murders from the night before to start asking questions about this arrested boat thief. Evidence of blood was found on Peter's uniform and inside the barrel of the rifle. Ballistics would later match the R4 found in his possession to the weapon used to kill the 3 victims. And Peter was charged with 3 counts of murder, and, after the autopsies, a count of rape was added. Headlines in the next newspaper edition spoke of the horrifying murders and the 19-year-old who'd been arrested for them. Pieter van der Merwe was taken for a psychiatric assessment prior to his trial starting. And it would be the results of that assessment that would later become the main question dealt with, both at his trial and at an eventual appeal. Pieter was found fit to stand trial in that he hadn't suffered from any mental health conditions at the time of his crimes that would have impeded his capacity to tell the difference between right and wrong, and he was capable of making decisions to align himself with what he knew to be right. He was also capable of understanding the trial process and assisting his counsel. The psychiatric assessment report would later be read into evidence, though, because it contained a diagnosis that the defense felt should be heavily considered as a mitigating factor. Two psychiatrists assessed Pieter, and both had found that he was what they called a certifiable psychopath of a severe degree. Now, that is not language we would use to describe psychopathy today, but it was the appropriate language back then. Dr. Merrill Forster testified that the traits of psychopathy included, quote, an absence of compassion, remorse, or self-recrimination, impulsiveness, a desire for instant gratification, an impaired ability to learn from past experience or to adjust to the demands of the community, an absence of motivation or drive, a conspicuous ability to manipulate others to their own advantage, inadequate interpersonal relationships, the susceptibility to substance dependence, and the tendency to perversion and criminality, end quote. Now, there was never really much doubt that Pieter was going to be found guilty of the charges against him. The evidence was simply too overwhelming, and he was found guilty of 3 counts of murder, 1 of rape, and several other charges relating to his theft of the boat, having robbed Paulina, and several other lesser crimes. The focus of the proceedings was always going to be the sentencing portion, because in March 1991, when he was being sentenced, the death penalty was still on the table. The judge considered the mitigating factors the defense presented, which they said had included his difficult childhood, his age, and the fact that he was a certifiable psychopath, and was therefore, in their impression, more likely than the average person to commit impulsive acts. This psychological disorder, the defense said, was not really his fault, so he should not be punished more severely than necessary for it. In aggravation, the judge considered that there had been no apparent motive for the crimes. The victims had been innocent people just going about their business, and Pieter had gone on a killing spree, committing 3 violent crimes one after the other, but with enough time in between to stop himself. This wasn't a mass murder, where he just opened fire on a group of people all at once. He had systematically hunted down these victims. In the end, rather than finding that psychopathy was a mitigating factor, the trial judge determined that it was an aggravating factor, in that Pieter could likely never be rehabilitated, and therefore, he said, in the best interests of the public, he should be put to death. Pieter was actually handed down 4 death sentences, 1 for each of the murders and also 1 for Paulina's rape, which the judge found had occurred under particularly brutal and cruel circumstances. It's always easy looking back at things with the gift of hindsight. And if Pieter van der Merwe and his lawyer had known what we know now, they wouldn't have needed to bother with the appeal they launched next, because the last person who would ever have the death penalty carried out against them had already been executed in 1989. As it would turn out, the constitution that was soon to be drafted and written into law would result in the death penalty being entirely repealed, and all those on death row at the time had their sentences converted to life. Conversations around this had already started behind closed doors by 1991, which is why no executions had been carried out since 1989, and never would be again. But, of course, Pieter and most members of the public did not know that. So Peter launched his appeal against his sentence. The main points of the appeal were that the judge had not correctly considered how Peter's psychopathy had affected his actions, and also that the first trial judge had a duty to select the least drastic sentence, which would provide the same result. And if the judge said he wanted the public to be protected from this unrehabilitatable psychopath, then he could just as easily have given him a life sentence. The appeal would take quite some time to come to court. And by the time it did in 1994, the Constitution of South Africa had already been written into law. And the appeal then also requested that the human rights, which were now protected by law, which governed offenders too, should apply as much to the person Peter was in 1991 as they did to who he was in 1994, even though the Constitution did not technically exist in 1991. In hearing the appeal, the judge said outright that they would really rather not deal with that last aspect unless they absolutely had to. And so they would address the first two aspects of the appeal and determine whether there was any merit in those. In 1991, the judge had essentially looked at Peter's psychopathy and said, no, this did not make you do anything. And if it did, we don't consider it an issue of impeded criminal capacity. So if there is this drive within your personality that causes you to do these things, and also it can never be fixed, then it's actually more of an aggravating factor than a mitigating factor. And it's even more reason for us to ensure you can never do it again. Also in 1994, the judge had seen Peter's killing spree as premeditated, and that was another reason he felt that the death penalty was warranted. The defense had argued that the nature of his psychopathy meant that he was impulsive, and that these had in fact been spur of the moment and not pre-planned actions. In 1994, the appeal judge looked at things a little differently. He noted that the psychiatrist had described Peter's psychopathy as, quote, almost like a disability, which impacted every area of his life. If, the judge said, this was her expert evidence, then the psychopathy should perhaps have been taken as a mitigating factor, because another type of disability may also have been under different circumstances. As for the impulsiveness versus the premeditation, the appeal judge didn't seem to think that the spree was completely premeditated. He decided that the first murder and the boat theft did seem to be impulsive actions, perhaps driven then by his psychopathy, which the expert said was like a disability. But the murder of Petrus Tsengho and the rape and murder of Paulina Sekala were definitely not the same as those crimes and could not be put down to impulsivity. Then the judge said that in deciding whether a life sentence was as effective as a death sentence in terms of keeping the public safe, he had to consider that members of the public still existed within the prison system. The staff would surely be at risk from an untreatable psychopath who, according to psychiatrists, would very likely commit future crimes of this nature if given half the chance. But, he reasoned, it was also very clear from his career in hearing criminal trials that there were many psychopaths in prison serving life, and none of them had been put to death because they would be a threat to the prison staff. The appeal judge said the following in summation, quote, "The effect of psychopathy, as I understand Dr. Forster's evidence concerning the behavioral pattern which is characteristic of this particular personality disorder, is that while it is not a disability as such, it is nonetheless a condition which places the psychopath at a certain disadvantage when compared with a non-psychopath. Dr. Forster said significantly, he lacks more control than someone who is not a psychopath. That fact, as well as the tendency to act without reflection, the impaired ability to learn from past experience, and the predilection for perverse or criminal conduct may not singly or collectively render the psychopath less able to tell right from wrong, but they would seem to constitute some impediment to his regulating his conduct in accordance with that distinction. End quote. He decided that Peter's psychopathy should therefore have been seen as a mitigating factor to an extent. But also, it weighs as heavily in the aggravating section, so much so that they would almost balance each other out. And the decision that the appeal court would be left with was whether it was necessary to put him to death to protect the public. And the appeal court decided it was not necessary. And so Pieter van der Merwe's death sentences were converted to life sentences. As I mentioned, this would have happened eventually anyway, as it was done for all death sentence offenders. But this case was pretty landmark at the time for its weighing up of the matter of psychopathy in criminals. And I will say that a lot of this conversation continues to this day, as we've come to better understand personality disorders. There are a lot of people who believe that personality disorders should be taken into account when criminal capacity is determined. I am not necessarily one of those people, but some of the questions this case has raised are interesting. If this case happened today, the conversation around the psychopathy elements would be very different. First and foremost, that word that both the appeal judge and the psychiatrist used, non-psychopath, would probably not be used today. Since the 1990s, the mental health community has come to understand that rather than being an issue of a psychopath or not a psychopath, psychopathy is actually more of a spectrum. And all of us have some level of these traits in us. But when they are significant and all together, that makes all the difference. The other thing we've come to understand about people with significant psychopathic traits is that the vast majority of them aren't in prison, and probably never will be. Often, they haven't committed any crimes either, and also never will. While the vast majority of people in prison do have some form of personality disorder, and often that does include antisocial personality disorder, of which psychopathic traits are often a significant part, we've come to understand that people with psychopathic traits specifically actually do very well in lots of other high-power positions, like CEOs of companies, heads of religious organizations, people in medicine who practice high-stakes roles like neurosurgeons, people in high-level law enforcement roles, and soldiers. Men and women who are trained to kill. We figured out over the years that psychopaths make really good soldiers under the right conditions. You may be familiar with a man called Andy McNab. He is a British soldier who has publicly acknowledged that he formed part of an Oxford University study which diagnosed him as having significant psychopathic traits, or what he calls a good functional psychopath. All of the same traits that make some others criminal offenders make him, and many like him, really good at their jobs. And we can't ignore that Pieter van der Merwe was also a soldier. In all fairness, he wasn't a very good one, but only really because he couldn't stick with the discipline side of it. He could not play by society's rules, while simultaneously maintaining his own inner ecosystem, if you will, of believing the rules did not apply to him. That is the balance that other individuals, who are pretty deep into the psychopathic spectrum, but also manage to never commit a crime and maintain brilliant careers, get right. And often, Those people would never describe themselves as psychopaths, and no one else would either, because they've just always known that they're a little different to everyone else and have managed to develop coping mechanisms to blend into society and never kill anyone. There's also a fascinating book I read about a woman who is a diagnosed sociopath. It's called Sociopath, and it's by Patrick Cagney. I highly recommend it. Unfortunately, there is no easy way to figure out whether Pieter van der Merwe is still in prison or alive, or if somehow he's managed to qualify for parole through the years. Many court cases have been held around some of the offenders who were on death row and had their sentences converted to life, especially since our life sentence and parole legislation has changed quite a bit since that happened. And many of those individuals remain in a sort of dead space of legislation where no one quite knows what to do with them. Some have had their sentences moved to take the track of our current legislation, so they've become eligible for parole, and van der Merwe may well be one of those. I know I have a few listeners who work in the departments of correctional services, and I do sometimes have people letting me know after I release an episode about a status of an offender they happen to know about, so maybe this will be one of those. While this case has been interesting in terms of the conversation around psychopathy and the fact that this is a relatively rare case that perfectly matches the definition of a spree killing, I don't want that to be the final thought we have in this episode, because none of that is more important than the three people who lost their lives. We will probably never know why Pieter van der Merwe decided to kill three people that night in 1990. The psychiatrists in his trial said it was probably because he enjoyed the violence. I think it's probably even simpler than that. He did it because he could. I don't agree with the first trial judge that Jacob's murder was impulsive. Pieter left the base that night with a gun for a reason. And he picked three people he thought he could probably get away with killing. He picked three people who would have felt intimidated by him, and he used that. He didn't kill his friend, Bezuidenhout, and that was, at least in my opinion, a very conscious decision, and only makes what he did even worse. Jacob, Beatrice, and Paulina were in the wrong place at the wrong time, through absolutely no fault of their own. And through a horrible twist of fate, they ended up in the path of an incredibly dangerous predator. I have no doubt that even now, 36 years later, there are still people who miss them. There is an entire lineage of families who know their names, and their absence is still felt. Their memories are still held with love. And that's something that they will always have, that their killer will never be able to achieve himself or take away from them. Jacob Morake, Beatrice Cienjo, Paulina Zekala, rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcast on social media platforms for updates on new episodes, my books, and events I attend across the country. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, head over to sacriminologist.co.za now. You can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. Use the code TCSA at checkout, and you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. In case you don't know, I'm also a true crime author with 4 published books: Samurai Sword Murder, Sizzlers, Killer Stories, and Bare Bones, which is also published in Afrikaans as Klipkoot. All of your support for the podcast and the victims of crime in South Africa is greatly appreciated. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.